Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we've got an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and greatest in the world of the automobile. Well, last weekend, folks, was the greatest weekend in the history of motorsports, and the last one we're going to see for a while, as we had the Formula One race from Monaco to start the day, Indy 500 in the middle, and ended up the end of the evening with the Coca-Cola 600. Well, that's the last year for this, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. We'll also catch you up on what's going on locally here with the Business Journal and some updates on the Valley automotive industry and the biz. I've got a weird and unusual article about the Yorktown, the carrier from World War II, a very cool article about a Pontiac, a 1958 Pontiac. Of course, we'll talk gas prices, and then it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten all the seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on The Car Show. Let's not bury the lead. Let's talk about the Indy 500 since I was attending another Indy 500. And as I mentioned before, my first one was back in 1969 when I was a wee lad of just 10 years old. Once again, the Indy 500 did not disappoint. It was a cool day, high of, I think, only got to 64. So it was one of the coolest 500s on record. And we had something that we don't see very often, and it has happened on these cold days, is we actually had an accident and a crash on the pace laps warming the cars up. And that was from Scott McLaughlin racing for Team Penske. He crashed on the main straightaway and was out of the race before it even started. This harkens back to 1992 when Roberto Guerrero was the pole sitter for the 500, and it was a cold day. It was only 58 degrees that day, and he crashed on the pace lap warming his tires up. So this is not unprecedented what happened. A little cool, a little wet, kind of sprinkles. But the race got started about 30 minutes late, which was a little tight for Kyle Larson. We'll talk a little bit about Mr. Larson in a bit. So cool, rainy day, but we got the race off, and it was fabulous. And the headline reads, Palou ticks the last boxes with an Indy 500 triumph. Well, Alex Palou has spent the last few years answering questions about what it would mean to add an Indy 500 win to the vast list of his achievements and championships. We won't have to answer that anymore. On the day that started off being mostly defined by chaos and mishaps, it came down to patience and calculations as Palou's number 10 Chip Ganassi hybrid Honda, Chip Ganassi Racing Honda, was behind Andretti's Marcus Ericsson, who benefited from alternate fuel strategy to take fuel and tires in the final phase of the race. Palou, needing to save fuel, seemed to be content to spend his final 20 laps tucked behind Ericsson, so he'd have to do what he needed to battle the last few laps. Ericsson seemed to be equally content to just keep him there. But Palou had spotted Devlin DeFrancesco and Louis Foster, who were the last two cars on the lead lap, just a further up the track. Well, one car's toe is good enough, and that toe means to get in their slipstream. So when Ericsson seemingly was still playing the long game, left the inside open going into turn one on lap 187, he probably was quite surprised to see Palou slide past him. Well, Alex Palou quickly tucked in behind the cars ahead of him, kept them in Ericsson in his mirrors, and listened for the word from his pit wall. And that came at lap 196 of 200. It says, burn all the fuel you need. Well, he didn't need all the fuel, and he was able to win the race. And there was a crash right at the end. Nolan Siegel crashed in turn two, but the leaders were already in turn four, and the deal was sealed. So Alex Palou wins the Indy 500, and he becomes the first driver from Spain to win the Indy 500. So Marcus Ericsson finishes second the second time he's finished second. He won the race in 22, finished second in 23, and now he finishes second in 25. Well, then comes tech inspection, and the next day, the headline reads, Andretti and Prima Racing penalized for Indy 500 tech violations. Well, technical series inspections found that three cars breached the rule book during Sunday's Indy 500, the number 27, 28 Andretti Global Hondas, and the number 90 Prima Racing Chevy, and they have been moved to the back of the field. So, they found some indiscrepancies, and they got fined as well. They lost $100,000, and the finishing orders. So the updated results, this kind of changes some things. So the updated results have Alex Palou winning the race. David Malukas moves up a spot. He now finishes in second. Pato O'Ward moves up a spot. He is now in third, and so forth. Felix Rosenquist in fourth. Santino Ferrucci drove a great race. He was in fifth. Christian Rasmussen in sixth. Christian Lundgaard in seventh. Connor Daly, my buddy, my friend, the guy who I want to win this race, led the lap, several laps at the race, finished eighth. Takuma Sato, ninth. And Elio Castroneves rounded out the top 10. So Kyle Larson attempting to do the double. That means run the Indy 500 and then go and run the Coke 600. He qualified mid-pack at the Indy 500. He qualified on the front row for the NASCAR race. And the headline reads, Larson unsure if double attempt is worth it after early finish to a rough day. Well, Kyle Larson didn't have the race day he had hoped between Indianapolis and Charlotte. If he could, he'd give it all a second try on Monday. But Larson knows that's not how it works. He's left with two incomplete races after crashing out of the Indy 500 and the Coke 600. Quote, I hate the way the day went, Larson said. At Charlotte Motor Speedway, I wish I could hit reset and try this all again tomorrow, but in reality, that's not going to happen. I feel terrible for everybody, Rick Hendrick especially, and everybody at Hendrick Automotive Group for the effort they put in to make this thing happen. It just didn't happen. Well, the crash in Indianapolis occurred on lap 92 when the car got away from Larson in turn two. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your viewpoint, the race-ending incident allowed him to leave Indianapolis and make it in plenty of time to get to the start of the Coke 600, where he had qualified in second position. Larson had a hard time getting out of Indianapolis shortly after 4 p.m. local time. The race was still not complete by that deadline. He would have had to pull Larson out of the car, but because of the accident, that didn't happen. Well, from the outside of the front row at the start of the race, well, he led the first lap. He briefly lost the top spot to Hendricks Motorsports teammate William Byron before reestablishing himself in the lead, and he led until lap 42 when he spun off of turn four. The incident occurred a few laps after he had hit the wall while leading the race. Larson was not in contention when he went after the spin. He was caught up in another rep on lap 246. Daniel Suarez was running wide off of turn four. Suarez came down and collected Larson and Justin Haley. So it was a two-year deal for Larson to run the Indy 500 with Arrow McLaren. And asked on Sunday how it played out, did he want to do the double again, or was he done with it? And he admitted it was a little too fresh to have a good answer. The double is just a tough undertaking. The window of time is too tight. If I didn't wreck, I don't know if I would have made it there in time. I probably would have had to get out of the car at Indy. So I don't know that it's really worth it. I would love to run the Indy 500 again, but just doing the double, I think, logistically, it's too tough. Larson is the sixth driver to attempt the double, and there's only been one driver to complete all 1,100 miles between Indianapolis and Charlotte in the same day, and his name is Tony Stewart. Well, let's jump into a little Formula One news, and, you know, I'm not the hugest fan of this race for Formula One. The Monaco race is really a parade. It's all about who gets on the pole, and most likely if you start first, you win, and that's exactly what happened. Lando Norris won the pole, and he won the race. Charles Leclerc finished in second. Oscar Piastri finished in third. Max Verstappen finished in fourth, and rounding out the top five was Lewis Hamilton. Now, what makes this, folks, interesting is the fact that this is the last year of running all these three big races on the same weekend. Next year, Formula One is moving to the weekend after Memorial Day. It's going to be actually the first weekend in June. So for those people who don't go to the Indy 500 because of Monaco, well, guess what? Now they can do both. And the people that haven't come to go to Monaco because of the Indy 500, you can do that as well. Coca-Cola 600 from last weekend, and the headline reads, Chastain comes from behind to win the Coca-Cola 600 at Charlotte. Welcome to the party, Ross Chastain, and the NASCAR Playoff Series and a winner. Well, starting from the rear of the field in a backup car his team needed to prepare all night, Chastain ran down the dominant car of William Byron last Sunday night to win the Coca-Cola 600 at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Byron led 283 laps of the 400 and swept the first three stages of NASCAR's longest race. Chastain led just the final six laps after diving below Byron's Chevrolet in turn one on lap 395, sliding up in turn two to clear Byron off the corner. Chastain crossed the finish line 6/10 of a second ahead of the Hendricks Motorsports driver for his first win of the season and his first time at Charlotte and the first win of, the first win at Charlotte and the sixth win of his career. So the top 10, Ross Chastain obviously won the race, William Byron in second, Chase Briscoe in third, A.J. Allmendinger in fourth, Brad Keselowski in fifth, Chase Elliott in sixth, Michael McDowell from Glendale, Arizona in seventh, Christopher Bell in eighth, Ryan Preece in ninth, and rounding out the top 10 was Noah Gregson. Well, from the pages of Old Car Weekly or Old Car Magazine, it's called Starring Chief, a 1958 Pontiac Star Chief with just two families since new. Well, even the best plans sometimes get set aside and reality presents itself and calls for some more serious rethinking. Well, I saw it advertised and kept looking at it, recalled Lloyd Schister, the owner of a 1958 Pontiac Star Chief shown in the picture in the magazine. And it's blue, baby blue with white, a white top. It's a 1958 four-door. I had a 1958 four-door hardtop, which I sold at Hershey. And then I found this Star Chief, and it was just too difficult to resist. Luxury Unlimited, the advertising proclaimed, explaining this was Pontiac's glamour model and matching bold engineering with a special flair of styling and performance. What the ads didn't say that motoring public knew by 1958 is that Pontiac had effectively reinvented itself over the past few years. Well, there was a new chief in town, and Pontiac arrived at the New York Auto Show in January of 1926 as a part of the General Motors scheme to leave no holes in the product line. The plan was to have an owner of a GM car move up the GM ladder to be less tempted to defect from one to their competition. Well, under that plan, the companion cars, well, Pontiac would be below Oakland and Viking above Oldsmobile and Marquette below Buick, LaSalle between Buick and Cadillac. LaSalle produced from 1927 through 1940 and had the distinction of being the longest surviving companion car, but the companion qualifier was critical. Well, the least expensive Pontiac in 1926 was a coach coupe priced at just $825, while those models that were Oakland range were $1,085 and $1,100 respectively. Not surprising, more than 76,000 Pontiacs were sold against only 57,000 Oaklands. The companion car sales continued to be healthy, and 1928 Pontiac outsold the upscale Oakland by almost 5-1. Well, what happened later was Pontiac became the choice and Oaklands went out of business. Now, by 1954, Pontiac was one of the last holdouts with a flathead straight eight, distinction shared with Packard, and the two would move into the modern overhead valve V8s for 1955. Pontiac's fellow GM divisions, Cadillac and Oldsmobile, had introduced the square over V8 design in 1949 and were quickly followed by Buick and Chevrolet. Now, Pontiac's basic engine grew to a 316 cubic inch for 1956, and the future was calling. Suggestions of speed dating back to 1935 was abandoned when the silver streak trims that adorned the hood and the trunk lid. The final appearance, Pontiac's days of the Chief of Sixes, well, that fell even farther in the rearview mirror with the coming of the V8s. Now, Schistler's 1958 Star Chief, when it was built, Pontiac's engines, which was now the Tempest 395, new horsepower, new torque out, new jeweled action response, the most advanced V8 on the road comes from Pontiac. Well, that's at least what the advertising said. Well, this vehicle for me, it was a family car. I've got a few receipts, not very many. They've had it repainted, and I'm quite sure they must have had the seats redone. They're in quite nice shape. It only has 76,000 miles on it. I think the only thing that they did on the motor was maybe a valve job, because I do have receipts for a valve job as well. It runs great, it rides smooth, and I really like it. We drove it probably about 1,000 miles last year. We probably drive it too much, to be honest, but it rides and drives so nice. Well, he had just driven 70 miles from his home in Ithaca, New York, to the Rolling Antiquers AAAC show in Norwich, and he said he wouldn't hesitate to drive this car anywhere. And beyond its reliability, there's another factor. When you ride along in it, it just drives like a brand new vehicle. It rides so good. No squeaks, nothing. Well, the Pontiac advertising had something to say about that, the way this car handles and rides, like no car you've ever driven before. The aero frame design contributed to the ride. The general comfort in this revolutionary backbone replaces a traditional ladder construction with a more stronger foundation and a lower roofline with no headroom loss. The wide floor panels for all passengers and the quad pose suspension made a comparable impact on handling, according to the ad copy, explaining that the unique suspension system gives the 1958 Pontiac a advanced roadability and handling ease. Upper and lower control arms are individually angled to create a compound geometry that minimizes pitch, sway, dive and braking, cornering, and straight line speed. Even with allowance for hyperbole, one would have to be impressed with this vehicle. A new kind of car is born, the division announced, planning for the ground up as the golden anniversary showpiece for Pontiac and General Motors. Now, Pontiac brings you scores of bold and basic advances in the modern automotive design, teamed together with a daring revolution on wheels. Well, this new car, lean, low, uncluttered, a bold new grille, was a complete breakaway from the 1957 design for Pontiac. And Schisler said it draws plenty of attention today. Identifying it, well, that's another matter. He knows that a lot of people will say, oh, I get it, it's probably from the late 50s, but they won't even guess unless they read the hood. They go, yeah, that's a Pontiac. Well, there weren't that many Pontiacs, as many as the Chevys that were sold, so I can understand why people would go, huh, a Pontiac. And she is a beautiful car, baby blue with a white top. Well, let's talk a little local automotive news, and this is from our friends over at the Business Journal. And the first article says, Robo-taxi production set to double in Mesa. Waymo says it's East Valley production to support the fleet growth across the United States. Well, Valley residents may soon see an increase in the Waymo robo-taxi. Taxis on our city streets. Waymo, in a partnership with a Canadian automotive manufacturer, Magna International, plans to double the production of the autonomous vehicles at its Mesa manufacturing plant, the company announced. Waymo, a subsidiary of the company Google, will assemble these vehicles, approximately 2,000 of these Jaguar electric I-Pace vehicles, at its 239 square foot facility in Mesa, and that will be by the end of 2026. That will add to the company's existing fleet of 1,500 robo-taxis. Well, the Waymo driver integration plant in Mesa is the epicenter of our future growth plans, and that's according to Ryan McNamara, the Waymo vice president of operations, said in a statement. With our partners at Magna, we have opened a manufacturing site that enables us for cost efficiency and flexibility and capacities to scale our fleet at new heights. When operating at full capacity, the Waymo driver integration plant is in Mesa will be capable of building in terms of tens of thousands of vehicles equipped with its autonomous technology every year, and the company, according to the company in its blog post. What more, Waymo will also integrate the sixth generation of the technology in these cars. Waymo did not disclose when it will ramp up full production capacity in Mesa, but a company spokesperson told the Business Journal that the autonomous vehicle automaker plans to introduce automated assembly line and other efficiencies over time. Business Journal first reported last August that Waymo had planned to build and outfit thousands of Jaguar I-Pace vehicles. Waymo also described the Mesa plant, which operates with Magna, as a multi-million dollar investment and creating hundreds of jobs. Waymo vehicles will be produced in Mesa, supporting a scaling of a nationwide fleet. Currently, right now, they operate more than 400 I-Pace vehicles in Metro Phoenix. And I saw one today as I was driving home. With more local automotive news, Carvana reports record sales in the first quarter. Well, the shares of Carvana Co., which was at full throttle since the Tempe-based used car retailer released its first quarter financial announcements from Wall Street, and they did better than expected. After the markets closed on May 7th, Carvana reported earnings shares of $1.51 on revenue of $4.2 billion in the first quarter, a 38% increase from the $3 billion in revenue from the prior year quarter. According to the FastSet analysts, projected earnings of 57 cents per share on revenue of $4 billion. So Carvana did very, very well. Carvana sold 133,000 cars in first quarter, marking another company high water mark, and reported gross profits per car of over $7,000 per vehicle. Carvana attributed to their upbeat results in the overall customer offerings, brand awareness, optimization of its proprietary technology, and an increase in inventory. They are also looking to use about a 3 million retail units each year. That's their goal. Once they get fully rolling, with a profit margin of about 13% per car and a 52-week high on their stock, which closed out at $310 a share. And that is a lot. Carvana is doing quite well. And to close out the local automotive news, the headline reads, Automakers Eye Lucid Arizona Factory's Capabilities. Well, Lucid Group is garnering automotive technology and manufacturing capabilities at its Arizona assembly plant. The California Electric Vehicle Company said on Tuesday that Lucid was engaging in a number of conversations with other automakers looking to leverage the electric vehicles company's Casa Grande, Arizona plant amid uncertainties over tariffs and the efforts to bring onshore automotive manufacturing. It's still early and our talks are preliminary, according to the president of the company, but we are looking at seeing what this current administration can do and how we can assist. Lucid acquired Nikola Corporation out of Coolidge, their manufacturing headquarters, and for more than $30 million out of bankruptcy court. And Lucid also hired 250 former employees from Nikola. So we'll see what happens as these guys try to see if they can help other automotive manufacturers with this very cool plant they have down in Casa Grande. Well, from the pages of Old Car Weekly, the headline reads, Old Ford Wagon Was Found Inside the Yorktown Carrier Wreck. So our weird and unusual automotive news. A crew exploring the wreck of the iconic U.S. Yorktown aircraft carrier recently made a surprising discovery. There was an old car on the ship. Submersible cameras spotted what to appear to be a 1941 Ford Deluxe Woody station wagon amongst the casualties when the famed ship was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine during the Battle of Midway in June of 1942. Well, the NOAA Ocean Exploration Team found the car on April 19th as a part of an exploration of the wreck, which was located about 1,300 miles northwest of Honolulu. The wreck of the Yorktown, famously known as the Fighting Lady, was found 25 years ago during a joint U.S. Navy and National Geographic expedition. The shipwreck has been well documented since its discovery, but they're still finding more things on board on the famous carrier. It wasn't immediately known why that Ford would have been on board, but among the theories are that it belonged to Rear Admiral Frank Fletcher, who possibly had brought the car on board for repairs after maybe getting damaged at the Battle of Coral Sea. So an old Ford found on an old aircraft carrier at the bottom of the ocean. Television this weekend. So we've got Formula One, IndyCar, and NASCAR all racing this weekend. Formula One is going to be in Spain, and then you've already missed that if you're listening to the car show. IndyCars are going to be on Fox today, and they're going to be racing in Detroit. And then if you have Amazon Prime, you can watch the NASCAR race, and that is from Nashville. And I'll have all results for all those races for you next weekend. Well, let's talk gas prices here. Right now, the average gas price in the United States is $3.16. $3.33 is Arizona. $3.94 is New Mexico. Colorado, $3.19. Utah, $3.03. Nevada, $3.88. And California, $4.08. I'll be coming back across the country. So let's see. Texas at $2.74. Oklahoma, $2.82. Missouri, $2.85. Illinois, $3.38. Indiana, $3.13. So we're going to do our best to avoid buying any gas in Illinois if possible. All right, let's see what's going on with our gas prices here in Arizona. Well, right now, the least expensive gas in the state of Arizona is in Sierra Vista, and that's $2.49 at a couple of the different Circle Ks in town. The Circle K in Yuma at $2.54. That's not bad. Huachuca City Circle K at $2.59. And the Speedway and Valero also in Sierra Vista, $2.59. So cheap gas, well, down south, certainly in Sierra Vista. prices in the metro are up. There's nobody under $3 a gallon. In fact, the least expensive in town is $3.07 at the Circle K on Grand Avenue in Surprise. These Costco on Waddell Road in Surprise also $3.09. And Arco Station on Grand Avenue, Glendale Avenue, Bell Road at $3.09. So right now, if you can find gas probably less than $3.25 a gallon, that's a great price. Well, we've come to that time in the show. It's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, my wife and I are driving a couple well-used cars. One is a 17-year-old, now G35, and the other is a 12-year-old Toyota Camry. We're considering purchasing a new car, a 2025 Camry, but after doing some research, we discovered that all the Camrys are now hybrids. I guess Toyota is doing all this to comply with the EPA mileage and pollution rules. Anyway, we've never driven a hybrid or know anyone who has one, so we don't even know what to expect. The main question is, if we purchase a hybrid, is there any big difference in how the hybrid drives and performs or acts? The new car will be driven mostly by my wife, and if one single thing about the new car doesn't please her, well, the whole fabric of the universe will come unwound. So any comments or advice would certainly be appreciated. And that's from Mike. Well, you should brace yourself, Mike. You'll notice a huge difference when driving a hybrid. You'll notice that you're suddenly getting 50 miles to the gallon, and you can go more than 600 miles between fill-ups. You'll also notice that your repairs and your maintenance costs have gotten lower. Because the hybrid uses regenerative braking, or it uses the spinning wheels to power the generator when slowing you down and recharging the battery, it'll take your brake pads and rotors much longer to wear out. And because you're going to be running on battery sometimes, well, guess what? Things like your exhaust system and your spark plugs, they're going to last much longer. In terms of driving, well, you'll notice that it's silent sometimes, and that's when it's running on battery power, and that's mostly at slower speeds. When needed, the gasoline engine will switch on and add more power. In some of the early hybrids, you'd really notice the switchover. But Toyota, which has been making the first mass-market hybrid back in 1999, has done a fantastic job of now making that switch back and forth be seamless. You'll hardly ever notice it. Now, some hybrid buyers ask if the hybrid battery will have to be replaced at some point in time, for several thousands of dollars at that. The answer is possibly, and possibly not. Most hybrid batteries seem to be lasting the life of the car. We see Toyota Priuses in the shop that are used as taxis with 250,000 miles on them, and they still have the original battery. So this is a great choice, Mike, and you should obviously drive it. But more importantly, you should have your wife drive it. I can't speak whether the fabric of the seats and the navigation system will be to her liking, but I guarantee you the power hybrid powertrain is great. Yeah, we have a Prius, and it's a hybrid, not a plug-in hybrid. Our kids have a plug-in hybrid, and they love it. So I absolutely think Toyota has done a fabulous job with this hybrid program. Well, folks, that's all the time we have for the car show. This is Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.